This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. Representative Robin Voss of Racine County was elected to the legislature in 2004. He is currently the longest serving assembly speaker in Wisconsin history. He's led a large and diverse Republican caucus, advancing significant policy reforms along the way. In the past year, he's faced some criticism about handling of the 2020 election. He joins us today to talk about all of these things. Thanks for checking in with us, Speaker
Voss. I love Wisconsin. Thanks for having me, Lisa.
Okay. So, longest serving speaker in Wisconsin history, I think, what, it's going on 9 years?
Yeah, it feels like longer.
So, is that something you envision for your career and the tenure that you've had in this role?
No, you know, it's interesting. I got elected in 2004, and I've kind of been through every possible combination of the legislature, where we were in the minority, the majority, split houses with a governor of each party. So I now appreciate the fact that when the founders brought together our democracy, they wanted the people's legislature, the Congress, or the legislature in each state to be the strongest part of our government. And I think, unfortunately, over time, we have seen more and more power cede away to the executive because it's a world where we want quick, easy answers, and that's usually what an executive can provide. They look in the mirror, they decide what they want to do, and they are able to execute it. So I love the challenge of being in the legislature. I love the ability to build consensus, argue with people, stand up for what you believe in. I think this will probably be the last elected job that I ever have. I had no desire to run for Congress or run for governor.
We're not going to see you on the ticket for governor?
No, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I love the job that I have, and I hope that I get a governor that I get to work with. That's the most important part of the job, is finding a way to generate consensus. And I think that's what I like to do in the Capitol, and that's why I love being Speaker. But I can certainly see why most people have a shorter tenure. I used to be head of the National Speakers Foundation, and one of the studies that they had done was that the job of speaker in a state is usually the biggest dead-end job that you can be in politics.
High burnout rate.
Partly because...
What's your secret?
Well, I just keep on going. But partly it is because if you see something good happening, you usually want to give credit to your members. You want to make sure that everybody has lots of it. And if there are bad things happening, you want to shield your members. So somebody said to me, I think it was Speaker Ryan, who said the job of speaker is really to be the heat shield for the caucus, where you take a lot of the bad things so that other members aren't forced to do that. And that's part of why the job, I think, is usually shorter lived than longer lived.
You have to have a really thick skin.
Yeah, that's what they say. Yeah, yeah. Or believe a lot in what you do. So, you know, and nobody likes to be criticized. I mean, I certainly think that, you know, the legislature has done a very good job over the course of the past, I would say, 30 years, but especially the past decade of leading and working with Governor Walker when we had the chance, and stymieing Governor Evers when he had his liberal wish list that we didn't want to follow. But really, we just have been blessed to work with a lot of really good, smart people, mostly from both parties, but obviously I work mostly with the Republicans, to get a lot of good stuff done.
Speaking of consensus, you have, what, a 61-38 majority in the mm-hmm. legislature currently.
Yep.
I'm guessing you would like to grow that a little bit.
I think we will.
Okay, so how does having such a large majority impact your ability to move the Republican agenda forward? Is that difficult?
Not necessarily, because, you know, most people obviously running on a ticket, you have a general set of philosophies that you believe in. It's interesting because some of my critics have said that, you know, you're around for so long that you end up just kind of pushing everybody around. And in fact, it's the exact opposite. If you meet anybody in our caucus of the 61 people, nobody's getting pushed around by anybody else. In the entire time that I've been speaker, I've never told anybody how to vote. I've really never even asked, because for the most part, we make a cause in caucus. We argue our points, and usually people get to the end mostly in the same place. So I think that's just the power of how the system works, where we argue, we debate. I think the smartest arguments usually rise to the top, and then we rally around those.
So even though it's a pretty diverse caucus, mm-hmm. you're able to find what that common ground is.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think there's a lot of diversity of opinion, but again, when you're exposed to the same set of facts, I think that most people accept those. The beauty of the system that our founders designed was that in the room of 61 and of the chamber of 99, there are experts on everything. Now, unfortunately, everybody thinks they're an expert on everything, but there really are people who are incredibly bright in every topic that affects our state. And usually people tend to listen to people who have the experience or the ability to articulate their point because of the research that they've done or the committee that they serve on. So I think the process works pretty well.
You just wrapped up the 2022 legislative session in March. What do you consider to be the biggest wins of this session?
Well, it's hard because, the biggest win, number one, was making sure that we did not expand the scope and size of government as Governor Evers would have pushed for. So that's a huge win. The fact that we started with a budget that would have dramatically increased everything from welfare to taxes, and were able to basically toss that out, start over, and have a budget that Governor Evers reluctantly signed that he's now taking credit for in his TV ads, I think that was a huge victory. The fact that a lot of the people on our side of the political spectrum said we want you to push and continue to advocate for things that we believe in, conservative ideas to reform Wisconsin, we did that. I'm not proud of the fact that we had a record number of vetoes, 127, more than any other governor in history. But I think it shows the divergence of opinion that we are pushing for what we believe in. I think we had a lot of really good ideas from expanding school choice, reducing the income tax burden, making it easier to own a firearm to protect yourself, dealing with crime, hiring more police officers, protecting human life. Lots of things that I think are general consensus items in Wisconsin, but Tony Evers is pretty far out of step, which is why a lot of those never became law.
You mentioned the record number of vetoes, and Governor Evers says he signed more bills than what he vetoed. He signed 267 laws. You mentioned 127 vetoes.
Yeah.
How do those vetoes impact your ability to communicate and work with the governor's office?
So this governor's office is the most dysfunctional in the entire country. I have the
Is that opinion or?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I have the ability, I was president of the National Conference of State Legislatures, former president of the National Speakers Association, so I get to talk to state legislative leaders from every state in the country, all ideologies, both political parties, and even my liberal Democrat friends who have a Republican governor are able to sit down and have a conversation and find consensus. And even my very conservative Republican colleagues are able to sit down with a liberal governor and have discussions and generate some kind of bipartisan work. When Governor Evers had a secret recording where he secretly recorded, and then never apologized for it, never held the staffer accountable, that's pretty unacceptable.
And then is that something that you are not able to get past?
I will never get past that. Right, because that is a breach of trust. That if you make a mistake, the first thing you do is admit it, you apologize, and you take actions to ensure that it never happens again. None of those occurred. So that's kind of a fault line that's pretty hard to get beyond. And then you add on top of it that we have sent letters saying, okay, let's try to sit down. Let's figure out some things that we could work together on. And Governor Evers has consistently said there's no need to do so. The fact that you have a casual chat at a bill signing is not meaningful consultation with people from the other side. But again, he has the right to be governor however he wants to. Unfortunately, he got elected in 2018. He sets the tone for how he wants the executive branch to operate, which in my mind is dysfunctional. And that's why when you look around the country, Republicans and Democrats in every state are able to sit down, but it seems like except in Wisconsin.
Governor Evers did talk about that at a recent in March WisPolitics luncheon. Mm-hmm. We're going to listen to a clip from him talking about how he assesses his work with bipartisan leaders.
Sure.
I remember them saying that to me. Well, are we going to meet every Wednesday like we did with Scott Walker? And I said, we'll meet, but I'm not Scott Walker. The pandemic played a role in that. I mean, the Capitol was closed for a while. So yes, do I think that there could be more help with, on our side and their side to make it happen? But if they want to get a hold, they have my number. I call them occasionally. They can call me.
He says, you have his phone number. Why not do more outreach to the governor's office? Why not give him a call?
Well, that's a little silly in the fact that, if there is a crisis, of course we would reach out to the governor's office. But meaningful consultation and building a consensus, you don't generate a working relationship on a casual basis. It's effort that you have to put in. Think of anybody who's watching the work environment that you are in. Imagine if the only time that you chose to talk to your boss was when you had an ask or you thought there was a problem. It just wouldn't generate the level of trust, especially when you have a different adversary relationship. So, Governor Walker, to his credit, met, I think, most weeks with Jennifer Schilling and Peter Barca as the leaders of their party. We kind of assume that was a standard in almost every other legislature across the country. You have regular consultation. I mean, one example would be Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, governor of Massachusetts, a Republican, a supermajority in each chamber. But when COVID happened, they actually rotated between the 3 offices to have meetings once or twice a week to say nobody is necessarily pro-COVID, nobody should not be on the same page. We couldn't even get that done. Governor Evers wouldn't meet with us. We had to meet with his chief of staff, as that's the only thing that he had time for. Well, if you expect to generate consensus, you have to work at it. So, yes, if there was a crisis, of course, I would call Governor Evers. But the standard idea that you're not going to generate consensus by only talking sporadically is one that I hope he would have learned at his stage in life.
There are a record number of legislators leaving office this year. I'm sure you're aware of that. We're showing a slide with all of the faces. 30 incumbents have announced they'll retire, won't seek re-election, or running for another office. This includes 13 Republicans in your chamber, the Assembly. Other states across the Midwest seem to be having kind of this similar exit. Do you see this as a trend? Is it concerning?
It's not concerning. It's actually healthy. I mean, the Wisconsin legislature has an average tenure of about 7 years in the Assembly. I don't know the Senate, but in the Assembly. So many people choose to serve for a short while. Some serve a little bit longer. I think that's healthy to have people who have much more experience, but also fresh ideas. When I look at where we are this time around, about half of the Republicans who are leaving are running for another office, so that's not surprising. And people want to not have this be their career. So an awful lot of folks got elected in 2010 and 2012 when we had, you know, the wave of what happened under Barack Obama, and then, of course, new districts in 12. So I think a lot of those people are looking and saying, okay, I've been here for 10 or 12 years. I want to do something different with my life. And that's where I think an awful lot of folks are going. So I'm excited. I love the idea of bringing new people in, having new conversations. You know, people go to the other chamber. I think all of it's healthy.
Some of the reporting on the exits talk about this hyper-partisan environment we're in. Do you think that it has any impact on whether or not somebody wants to stay in the legislature?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, we have gotten to the point where politics is such a brutal sport is the wrong word, but that's, I think, the way people look at it. It's such a brutal enterprise. There are groups, and I guess I feel them on my side of the aisle, which spend all of their time trying to go after people personally. Lawsuits, open records requests designed to do nothing more than to stymie the process, trying to muckrake to make people look like they are doing something wrong when they're clearly doing just their job. And I'm sure both sides do that. That is a cancerous environment that we are in, where it makes good people, number one, say, I'm not sure I want to enter public service. I see that as I try to recruit folks. And it makes the people we're in say, is this where I want to spend a significant chunk of my life in an environment that sometimes is unhealthy? You know, we have tried to do all kinds of things over my tenure. We generated the first of its kind in the country, Memorandum of Understanding, to try to limit debate and make it more focused and make it less personal. I think it was successful for a while, but then the leaders changed and the style became even more combative. And I think that's part of the challenge that we have, that, you know, instead of having an argument about what is the beliefs, it's almost always focused on why the other side is evil as opposed to why the policy might be misguided. So I think it's challenging, but I'm optimistic. You know, we've gone through these times before where there have been hyper-partisan times and people get through it. They figure a way to generate consensus.
Do you try to coach new members on how to do less of that?
We do some of that. We have pretty extensive training on our side of the aisle. There is bipartisan training that occurs from the Legislative Council. We have brought in NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures. They do training. So we have tried to do that, but I really believe that the people who run for office in many ways are a reflection of society. I think it was significantly healthier when you did not have Facebook, where you could have an instant opinion on everything and put it out there for people, which might be caustic to people who don't agree with you. I think that's part of the challenge that we have, that people have the ability to be less genuine in their comments because they make things as if they know you, but they only know you from Facebook. So I think that's part of the challenge that we have. So one of the goals that I have is to at least have a discussion. There's an organization called the National Institute for Civil Discourse. They're out of Ohio State University. I've worked with them through NCSL. So I would like to at least have a discussion to see if there are things that we can do which would help to foster better relations. Like I say, I feel like we had that in the past, and it's grown less so with some of the new members on the other side of the aisle who are much more caustic. But we got to figure a way to get beyond that.
So that's a goal for next year?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
How do you go about recruiting new members to the legislature if you have some of these seats that are going to be open? Is there certain ways that you try to persuade somebody to run for office?
I really don't persuade. I mean, the funny thing that works is usually we'll talk to the retiring member and say, give us a list of 10 people that if you thought they would be a good member, you know, whether they've ever expressed an interest, we'd love to approach them. So that's a lot of the way that we find good people is literally just by recommendations. But this time around, I think there is such an intensity on our side of the aisle. It feels a lot like 2010 or 1994, where I'm pretty sure it's going to be a red wave. There are people who are stepping forward much more than normal. People in every part of the state, every walk of life, who, even though the world they worry about entering into is kind of caustic, they also know something's wrong. I mean, we're paying too much for gas. We can't find baby formula. You know, I mean, you name the topic, something is wrong in our country. And then you add on top of it some of the moral values that we are seeing just so clearly on the decline, where we are seeing things taught in school that are beyond the pale for what most parents want. And then the parents who rise up and say something are called domestic terrorists. I mean, there's just a level of animosity that shouldn't be there. So I think a lot of people want to rise up and come above
it. That's what's motivating people.
I think so, yeah.
I'm going to ask you something you probably never get asked about.
Okay.
The 2020 elections investigation.
Yeah.
So you've said in the past that you believe it's important to seriously consider Wisconsinites' distrust in the election process, that's important. We're showing some data from the Marquette Law School poll that kind of tracks how people feel about this. In Wisconsin, about two-thirds of Republicans expressed little or no confidence in the 2020 election results. Voters were asked about that again in the spring election, which is different, but Republican confidence was greater. They were 76% said that they were confident in those spring election results. All registered voters, 84%. Said that they are somewhat or very confident in the accuracy of that April result. You've gotten pushback from both sides about the 2020 election process. Some say you're doing too much. Some say you're not doing enough.
Trust me, I get them all. Yeah, that's right.
you get it from both sides. What questions do you think are still left unanswered about the 2020 election?
So I think I try to divide the election into really two parts. Three parts, really. What happens before a ballot goes in the machine, what happens before the results are certified, and then what happens after people begin to serve, okay? The first section, I have been as clear as I possibly can be, that once somebody is sworn into office, you cannot go back and redo the election. You just can't.
Some people are unhappy with that answer.
Trust me, I know. But I would say if there is an overwhelming amount of fraud that is proven in a court of law, not just suspicion, not just something that we think happened, but that we are able to prove. That's the only time that you can go back and do something like that. In my mind, that this portion in the middle, I do not believe that the machines changed ballots, right? I do not believe that those things are real, but I do believe what occurred before the election is a serious problem that we've got to focus on, and that's where Justice Gabelman has been putting most of his effort. It has been, is it right for a billionaire to come in and sign a contract mandating that a municipality conduct an election in a certain way? Is it permissible, in my mind, to have things where you have unsecured drop boxes all over the municipality where we have no idea what's happening? Ballot harvesting is a real problem. It's illegal, but we don't have a way to necessarily enforce that. We know that we had indefinitely confined in nursing homes where we saw people who fraudulently filled those out. We now know we had people filling out ballots in nursing homes. How widespread that is, we'll never really know. But the challenge is there are real problems that undermine our election.
And you think there are still questions then?
Oh, I talk to people, as I say, I'm going door to door now. And I would say by far the largest issue that people bring up to me is inflation, food costs, the cost of living, you know, all the economy and those things. But a subset of that is people who are worried about whatever happens in November not being trustworthy. And that's the biggest thing that I wish the Democrats would have been able to understand about Justice Gabelman's investigation is we need to make sure that even if it's only half the population, that the half who questions what happened in 2020 go into 2022 and 2024 with a belief that we have either fixed what the problems were or that we have confidence in the final results. And I think what the Democrats have done, which is to really stymie the investigation, file lawsuits, attempt to say we can't issue subpoenas, all the lawsuits we're involved in, really makes those on this half of the spectrum question the results even harder than they did before. So I really feel like there was a way for us to generate consensus. We tried to reach out to the Democrats. They wouldn't do that because it serves their own political interest, and I think that's kind of sad.
Can we restore trust in the election process?
I think we will. I mean, we passed 14 different pieces of legislation, 3 constitutional amendments. Every one was vetoed by Governor Evers, which I think was cynical because many of them were truly nonpartisan based on the audit. But he has a role to play where he wants to generate maximum effort to say that we're somehow attempting to suppress the vote or to steal people's votes, which is the opposite of what we're trying to do. We're just trying to make sure people have a right to know that the elections are secure at the end of the day and that everybody has a chance to cast their ballot legally, fairly, and one time. So I hope that once we get past the fever of November, you know, there are those of us who are going to focus on making sure we do everything we can. The Republican Party has done a record job of recruiting poll workers to be at the polling place to guarantee that nothing nefarious happens in most of the places where we suspect something might have happened wrongly at the polling place. We also need to do a better job of reaching out and ensuring that people follow the law. You know, you're not allowed to ballot harvest. That's illegal. It's a crime. You're not allowed to do some of the things which have been standard practice on the other side of the aisle. We've got to make sure we hold people accountable for not breaking the law as well.
More work to do.
Yeah.
In the past 2 years, there's been a series of protests related to the relationship between law enforcement mm-hmm. and communities, particularly communities of color. We've also seen an interest in crime, which I know in your home community, I think you had written that it's homicides have doubled in Racine mm-hmm. since 2022. You initiated the Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities, some good work happening there. Mm-hmm. What do you think, what more needs to be done to kind of both restore that relationship between law enforcement and communities of color and address rising crime?
So I think we did a really good job, led by Majority Leader Steinicke, to try to find that consensus. I mean, he and Representative Stubbs, the co-chairs, I think did an excellent job of finding consensus on certain things. We've increased training. We have a grant program for body cameras. We are making sure that if people do something wrong, they're held accountable. But I also want to make sure that we thank people who are in the police department and do work inside that area of our government, because we see there's a record number of people who aren't applying for jobs. It's a really difficult role to be a police officer today because there's a lot of snap judgment based on a 10-second video that somebody might have clipped that instantly becomes a nationwide sensation. So, you know, I think we should have done more to stand behind the police. I mean, if you remember, we passed legislation to give recruitment bonuses to hire more people to work there. We put more money into ensuring that we would lock up people who are repeat offenders, who would commit regular random crimes. And then Governor Evers vetoed those. So I just feel like on some of the consensus items where most people feel that rising crime is a problem, except I guess if you're Governor Evers, you don't. Well, I think that really sends a bad message to people who want to be in law enforcement, that the folks who are either in the prosecutor's office or in general government, like under the attorney general, under the governor, that they don't stand behind our men in blue, men and women in blue. And that's just wrong. So I think that's part of our challenge that we have to say, if you commit a crime, you should go to jail. And on your way out, we should make sure that you have the ability to rehabilitate, get your life back on track once you've paid your price of, once you've paid your time.
Governor Evers has put in some of that federal ARPA money into law enforcement initiatives.
Well,
is that
really,
not enough?
Not really into law enforcement. It's a lot of things that are kind of keeping people hopefully out of the criminal justice system, which I give credit. I mean, we will certainly want to help people avoid making a bad mistake or doing restorative justice. I agree with many of those ideas, but that is not the same as helping to make sure that people who commit a crime are behind bars quickly and that we do a better job of investigating the crimes that are happening. Record homicides, when the mayor of Milwaukee, from what I read in the newspaper, I have not had a chance to speak with him about it yet, but the ideas seem kind of small ball when you need to really be focused on locking people up who are repeat offenders and getting them into prison quicker. We don't seem to focus on that as a priority. Low bail. We saw what happened in Waukesha, where the governor really has basically said very little about that until there was a huge public outcry. I mean, it just seems like oftentimes it's a day late and a dollar short, and that's not good enough.
Clearly, crime will be on voters' minds in fall. What are the other top three issues other than crime you think voters are going to?
I think crime is right at the top. I think food prices and, the rising cost of everything in our society, food shortages. I mean, you walk into a grocery store and sometimes it feels like a movie from the 1980s showing the Soviet Union, where you don't have all the items that you want, that you live in the most prosperous country in the world and you can't get the basic items because we've made some bad decisions.
I would say the governor's fault?
It's partly, but not entirely. It's the philosophy that he believes in. I think we made a decision to give people free money. Remember the bonus unemployment for not working. That stayed on a lot longer than it should have. Governor Evers kind of kept giving people bonus food stamps who didn't necessarily need it. We've not done a look back. If you remember, we used to have a requirement in the law where every once in a while you look at somebody's income to guarantee that they were now below the threshold. We more or less stopped doing that. So people kind of get on benefits and kind of stay on that until we hopefully get a Republican governor. So I think we've given people too much of a safety net. And now we're at a time with record low unemployment where you can have a job in almost any community if you're willing to look. And unfortunately, we don't see people kind of coming out of the woodwork to do that.
So you think there's too many people sitting on the sidelines?
Yes, we have a low unemployment rate, but that also means a lot of people have taken themselves out of the workforce, and that's unhealthy for our state and our economy. So I think that the ability to give away a lot of free things that Governor Evers did with federal money was really very bad that we've got to fix. So that's a big issue that I hear from employers, but frankly from people who are working, saying they're frustrated that a lot of people are home on the couch while they're putting in double time to be able to get the product out the door that we all need. And then I would say lastly, probably the most important thing that we've got to figure out is kind of the state of where our society is, and it's really embodied through education. CRT and the entire idea is just one segment of a much more difficult conversation that we are seeing that I think that some of the conversations we're having with young people really are helping to contribute to a lot of the problems that we see in society. We know that the lockdowns, we have a record number of young people who are either have or are considering suicide. We have major mental health problems. I think we've done a bad job of holding kids accountable. We have almost a lost generation of kids who went through a year or two of school where every teacher was just told, just pass the kids, it's pandemic, and they were not taught the basic things that helped them to be onto the next phase. We see in college similar things that are happening. We have a record low number of kids who have their driver's license because we see it's almost like parental Uber. You don't need to have your license to go to a job like maybe you and I when we were younger. A lot of young people aren't working like they should be to be able to get that work experience, to build a work ethic, to be able to help grow our state. So I think we've done a bad job with an awful lot of young people with the direction that we've been pushing the state. So I think we got to focus on that. So really education, CRT, how do we make sure people are off the sidelines, and then the entire idea of crime and how we deal with that. Those are probably
the
biggest issues.
Those are the three
biggest issues. And then from my own standpoint, I think when we come back, we need to address how the governor, whoever it is, whoever he or she is, dealt with the pandemic and the powers that were given to them wrongly by my colleagues in the past. So we need to look at some of those things that they had.
Executive powers.
Mm-hmm. That's a big problem that we need to rebalance.
Republican or Democrat.
Okay, same thing. It doesn't matter who wins the governor's office. We should do it. Now, obviously, I hope a Republican would be open-minded. I think Governor Evers is pretty stubborn, and as you said earlier, doesn't really want to work with us, so that's a challenge. So I hope we get a different governor to do that.
You mentioned inflation and high costs, record inflation. Is it time to look at local levy limits, relieve some of that pressure on local communities?
We're going to have to figure out how they help to pay for their costs. Now, I don't know what the right answer is. I mean, some have talked about shifting a portion of the state sales tax so the tax burden would remain the same, but maybe we'd redistribute it. Others have talked about doing a one-time levy limit exemption or allowing some certain things to be combined in a way that would hopefully generate savings. All of those ideas should be at least discussed. I am very leery at a time with high inflation where most people's wages are not keeping up with the cost of living to just say, well, we're just going to raise your taxes and you'll have to figure out how to deal with it. That's probably not a good thing for us to do. But I think your point is valid. When you have rising costs of everything from electricity to insurance benefits to just wages to pay to somebody who works collecting our garbage or protecting us on the street as a police officer, they have to have a wage increase that is probably beyond where we have been in the past simply because of inflation. So we're going to have those conversations. And that's where I do think that having a Republican governor would allow those conversations to be more fruitful and more productive. Governor Evers, again, doesn't really want to work with us. So the chances of finding a consensus with somebody who doesn't want to talk is probably a little challenging.
Another issue where there's obviously great divide is abortion. Mm-hmm. In the daily headlines, we expect the Supreme Court to perhaps do something. What needs to happen in Wisconsin on the issue of abortion?
Well, first of all, the conversation has to start with what is the decision that's made by the court. We do not know. We have supposition, so I think that has to be step number one. I have been very clear that, first of all, I'm Catholic. I am proud of my religion, and I'm, you know, somebody who follows my faith as closely as I'm able. No one's perfect. But I certainly think that in the Catholic tradition, we want to guarantee that the mother's life is at least equally, if not more predominantly, considered when a child is in danger or there's a challenge going forward. So for some people who say they want no exceptions, even the life of the mother, I think that's a position that's outside the norm in our society and not one that I support.
Does that mean that Wisconsin, that you have to come back in a session?
No, we already have the exception for the life of the mother in the law. So that is current law today. But I know there are some groups who are pushing to get rid of that exemption. I think that would be a mistake. The second thing is I have taken in the past a position to say that if a woman is subject to the trauma of rape or incest, that we should at least have a conversation to say, you know, what what is a reasonable way for the family to be involved? Probably not to the ninth month of pregnancy, obviously. But, you know, if it's immediate, if it's reported to the police, I think there should be some conversation about that. None of the people running for governor on our side, I think, is in favor of that. So that would be a challenging conversation for us to have. It would take some time. But again, I don't know what the law is going to be based on what the Supreme Court says. So I just think we have to be somewhat open-minded to say, we don't know what it's going to be. I want to look at the impact on families, not just women, but all families, to say, how do we make sure we do the most to protect innocent human life, while at the same time also trying to make sure we can generate consensus in society as we move along, so we don't have another incident like this where Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided because it was a court injecting its opinion for that of the elected officials. And that's why for now over 50 years, we have not generated a consensus in society where it's almost evenly split between both sides. So my hope is that if they return it back to the states, we have the ability to work on generating that consensus. So at least in Wisconsin, the more than 50% of the people will think the choice that we make is the right one, and we won't have this constant back and forth where people feel the need to argue about it.
You just came out of the GOP convention this last weekend. You have a crowded primary field for governor on the Republican side. Will you endorse someone in the primary?
So I've been the most supportive of Rebecca because I think she has the experience and the ability to articulate a message that would be a great contrast with Tony Evers. I will say she is my first choice, but there are others where I think if Tim Michaels won the primary, I think he would be a good candidate going forward. I have some questions about Kevin Nicholson and Tim Rampton as to whether or not they could ever really be elected statewide, but I think we have some very good choices on our side of the aisle. I think that the focus needs to be on not where we differentiate each other, because I think most of the, you know, I think Tim Michaels and Becky Clayfish are pretty close in what their opinions are. I think you might want to look at who has the ability to deliver the message, what their background is, you know, what their experience is. All those things are things that conservative voters in the primary should consider. But my number one preference is that we need somebody besides Tony Evers, because I've seen what it looks like up and close, and it's not pretty. We need to have somebody else in the governor's office. So my hope is that we're in a year where Republicans are favored, but it doesn't mean that it's easy. Wisconsin's a swing state. We still have to appeal to people with a vision of what we want to do. And I think that's what hopefully after the primary we'll see Rebecca or Tim Michaels or whoever it would be able to articulate in a close and easy contrast with Tony Evers.
So we shouldn't expect an official endorsement from you before
Probably
August.
Not. I mean, I had said early on that I thought having a competitive primary only helped Tony Evers. I think history is going to prove me right because he is sitting back running commercials that I would say are untrue, pretty much unaccountable to anybody because he has no primary. And we're here arguing about how many angels fit on the head of a pin, right? I mean, we're very small differences, and that really helped him. So I want to focus on why his record has failed Wisconsin and why we need somebody different.
The
sooner we can get to that, the better.
Yeah. In the 2020 midterms, when Governor Walker beat Tom Barrett, there was kind of this new 2010.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
There was this emergence of the Tea Party movement. Mm-hmm. That was the conservative wing at the time. Now, you know, more than 10 years later, how do you see the party changing? Is there more divide? What's that look like?
So I think we are significantly more diverse in our opinions than where the Democrats are. I don't have any polling to show this, but it's kind of one-third traditional conservative, you know, pro-business Republicans, one-third more social conservatives, and I would say one-third more populist kind of Trumpy, you know, in that idea. So, you know, just as it was hard in the very beginning for social conservatives and some of the business conservatives to coalesce together in the early 80s, it eventually happened because they realized that they had more in common than they had with the other side. I think that's the way it's going to be with a lot of the populists who are coming in from President Trump, the new folks he's brought into the party. But at the same time, we just have to remember that nobody in this coalition is the enemy of the other. And frankly, we pretty much believe all the same things. The other side is that we have to challenge their ideas, and it should be focused on ideas, not personalities. When I look at where the Democrats want to take Wisconsin, expanding welfare, increasing taxes, reducing support for the police, I mean, you name the topic, it is not, in my mind, good for the state. And it's why the message should be pretty clear, as long as we focus on doing that going forward and not arguing with each other about things that are relatively minor.
You mentioned former President Trump. What's your relationship with the president?
It's good. I mean, I talk to him on a fairly regular basis. I probably haven't talked to him in a couple weeks. But, you know, it's certainly good. I probably talk to him dozens of times. I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm certainly dozens of times. I think that overwhelmingly he has been good for the party, bringing in new people who perhaps didn't know they were Republican. You know, I was on a conversation this morning with somebody who runs a lot of crews that, you know, build houses, work with their hands, you know, everybody from the mason to the guy who puts the roof on. And most of them are rabidly Republican now, because they, number one, see what's happening under President Biden. But they were also kind of given permission by Donald Trump to say, you know what, we want people like that to be in our caucus, in our party, in our movement. And I think that's good for the party. We have got a lot more people who are coming in than those who are leaving, and I think that's healthy.
You've got a busy summer ahead of you.
Yeah.
And busy next year. You're from Wisconsin, native Wisconsinite. How do you relax? What's your favorite place to go in the summer in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, there's a lot. Obviously, just like the easy ones, we love Door County. I live right by Lake Geneva, so my wife and I try to go there at least a couple times a summer. So I think we are blessed that we have so much to offer. But frankly, Lisa, during the summer, I am going to get to see the hills and valleys and streets of Racine County, because I get to go door to door. So I'll come back with a tan. You know, I will have an opportunity to hopefully lose a little bit of weight. But that's what we spend a lot of our time doing. Is I usually go door to door somewhere between 3 and 4 days a week. So I try to put in 20 to 30 hours just listening to people, hearing what they want to talk about. So that is what I get to do this summer to relax. And hopefully a lot of my other candidates will do that, too.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thanks,
Lisa. I always enjoy it.
And thank you to the viewers of Newsmakers. And be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.